The Ozarks at Large podcast is made possible by KUAF's contributing listeners. Support from individual listeners in our community helps pay for the cost of producing and distributing this podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast and other digital media produced by KUAF, you can make a contribution at supportkuaf.com.
Good evening. It's 6 minutes after 7 o'clock, and this is 91.3 KUAF, a service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. KUAF has been your home for NPR news coverage of events for 33 years, and we've been your home for classical music since 1985. In just under an hour, Katie Hendrickson will host tonight's Of Note, the state's only locally produced daily classical music program. That begins at 8 tonight. Clear conditions are expected to continue through the night for the region. Lows will be in the mid-20s tonight in northwest Arkansas and the upper 20s for the Arkansas River Valley. Highs tomorrow, again with clear conditions, should be in the lower 50s throughout the area. The Arkansas Legislature's fiscal session is forecast to continue tomorrow as well. It opened today at the state capitol. Governor Asa Hutchinson says he knows much attention this session will be paid to the reauthorization of Arkansas Works, the state's way of expanding Medicaid to more residents. The last version passed by a slim margin, and three state senators who voted for it then have either resigned or died. The governor says he doesn't think reauthorization in 2018 is so much about flipping votes as redesigning the Arkansas Works framework to meet conservative ideals.
It's really not them changing a consistently held position. It's a matter of them looking at this and saying the reforms that we've always advocated for are now in place. And so they would feel comfortable in supporting it based upon that. The Medicaid waiver is a part of it, but it's also what we were able to do last year in tightening up our review process to make sure people who are not eligible for it from an income standpoint are not receiving benefits. And we rolled 117,000 people off both traditional Medicaid and the expanded Medicaid just in 2017.
The governor made his comments during an interview with Roby Brock from our partner, Talk Business and Politics. This week's fiscal session is the fifth such specific session since a voter-approved constitutional amendment specified its necessity. As Bobby Appison of Arkansas Public Media reports tonight, if the session goes smoothly, that's probably because the state's budget is pretty modest and well-guarded.
Arkansans like to say, thank God for Mississippi. But when it comes to our state budget, we ought to be thankful for Oklahoma. That state is dealing with a historic budget shortfall.
1 in 5 Oklahoma schools now holds classes just 4 days a week. Last year, Highway Patrol officers were given a mileage limit because the state couldn't afford to put gas in their tanks.
That's reporter Rachel Hubbard of KOSU in a recent report on Morning Edition. Oklahoma's Republican governor now is touting a plan developed along with business leaders to raise taxes. In Arkansas, Governor Asa Hutchinson has cut taxes twice. And beginning today, the legislature will take up the governor's lean $5.6 billion budget.
I've presented a balanced budget that actually creates a $64 million surplus that funds education, the priority needs of our state. I'm hopeful that the legislature will greet that well.
The challenge, he said, is to protect that surplus. And because Hutchinson's Republican Party fills more than three-quarters of the seats in the House of Representatives and most of the Senate, too, he may get everything he's asking for.
You know, it's important that they'll look at public safety issues. I don't think there'll be a whole lot in terms of education because we've met our adequacy requirements there that's sufficiently funded.
Anytime we say that education is adequately funded or that we've met adequacy, I just want to punch something.
That's Fayetteville Representative Greg Letting, a Democrat. And he's right that the budget meets just basic funding levels for public education this coming fiscal year. What's Letting prepared to do about it?
The one problem being in the House right now, being a Democrat in the House, is that there are 24 of us. So we don't have any kind of leverage because the Republicans, having more than three-fourths of that chamber, can pass any appropriation without a single Democratic vote.
In fact, the real floor debates might take place between Republicans.
I don't know that there's a big fight looming. I would say there's going to be some pretty deep discussions about Arkansas Works.
Well, it's been for the last several sessions, and that's Arkansas
Well,
Works.
You're still going to have the continuing debate on Arkansas Works.
That's Representative Les Eaves of Searcy, Senate President Pro Tem Jonathan Dismang, and Capitol reporter Wesley Brown. The governor has sought, and some say gotten, and is about to announce federal permission to implement work requirements for Medicaid recipients, as well as stricter eligibility standards. That will make Arkansas's version of Obamacare more acceptable to many hardline conservatives. Medicaid is a billion-dollar line item in the state budget, and one that many Republicans repudiate. But the governor has maneuvered to keep it in some form because it means perhaps $100 million from the feds coming into the state for health care each year. The fiscal session is scheduled to last 30 days, and it may be extended.
There's been some talk that because there's three vacant seats in the Senate, that this could be extended if we don't get the votes on Arkansas Works and Medicaid that the governor needs, and then these lawmakers like to stay up here and get that per diem too.
What's happening in nearby Oklahoma and Kansas too is a reminder that steep and consistent cuts to revenue, that is taxes, often curb state services people like.
Oklahoma, you got kids going to school 4 days a week. That is horrible. Think about the long term.
Greg Letting is seeking a Senate seat this election year, while the governor himself is up for re-election. That, he says,
allows a little bit of room for some games to be played from time to time. We'll watch that, and let's save some battles for down the road.
In Little Rock, Bobby Ampazon, Arkansas Public Media.
Support for Arkansas Public Media comes from Simmons Bank, with more than 90 community-based locations in Arkansas providing banking and lending services. More information is available at simmonsbank.com. Simmons Bank, dreams realized.
What happens at this month's fiscal session will have an impact on Arkansans' lives for some time to come. We move now to an incident that happened more than 100 years ago that still has influence on legal matters today. Tomorrow afternoon, Mark Curadin will be on the University of Arkansas campus to discuss his book, Contempt of Court, a turn-of-the-century lynching that launched 100 years of federalism. Curadin's book recounts the arrest of Ed Johnson, a black man, in Chattanooga, Tennessee, for a rape he didn't commit and his subsequent lynching. Friday, we reached Mark Curadin and asked him more about the case. He says it began in January 1906 as a woman named Nevada Taylor was headed home after work and stepped off the Chattanooga trolley.
And all of a sudden, a man comes up behind her. He has a leather strap. He puts it around her throat. He says, if you say or scream, I will kill you. And then he eventually rapes her. She calls the police, the sheriff, or actually her father did. A couple of days go by. They make no arrest. As a matter of fact, the victim, Nevada Taylor, doesn't even say in her police report that the attacker was white or black. But the sheriff automatically assumes that he is black and gives that to the newspaper. And a couple of days later, an informant comes forward who's paid $350. And this is in 1906, which is a lot of money. It's about 6 months' salary for the average day laborer in 1906. And he provides the name of Ed Johnson. And Ed Johnson, who was 19, is then arrested and charged with the rape of Nevada Taylor.
Ed Johnson maintained his innocence and had an alibi. Witnesses saw him at work at the time of the crime. Still, an all-white jury, seated just days after Ed Johnson was charged, finds him guilty and sentenced him to death. Johnson's original attorneys, at the direction of the judge, encouraged him not to appeal. But the only two African-American lawyers practicing in Chattanooga stepped in. An appeal does make its way to the United States Supreme Court, and the execution is stayed. As news of that stay reached Chattanooga, word developed a lynch mob would form. Instead of increasing protection at the jail to protect Johnson, the sheriff reduced the staff to one elderly guard. A mob did develop, broke into the jail, and took Johnson away, murdering him, lynching him from a bridge in Chattanooga, and shooting him multiple times. His murder is not, however, the end of the story.
When the Supreme Court learns that the sheriff and the other officials in Chattanooga had basically ignored their orders to stay at Johnson's execution, they become very upset, and they order federal marshals to Chattanooga. Evidence is unearthed that they had basically were in cahoots with the lynch mob. You know, basically they charged the sheriff and the deputies and the leaders of the lynch mob with criminal contempt of the Supreme Court, and they put them on trial right in the Supreme Court. It's the first and only criminal trial ever held in the history of the Supreme Court of the United States.
Mark Curadin says the case of Ed Johnson's murder still has influence over contemporary legal matters. He says the American Bar Association used the case as an example as a need for the establishment of basic rules of evidence.
Standard of conduct, a code of conduct for lawyers, and requiring them to represent clients fully. And so that's number one. Number two, the case has since been cited numerous times as demonstrating the power and the influence of federal courts and the federal constitution over the state courts.
Currodin says though the case had been in relative obscurity before his book, it was cited during the Watergate hearings when the Supreme Court directed the president to turn over tapes to a federal district court. And Mark Currodin says before his account was published, there was also little in Chattanooga to let people know about the crimes associated with the case.
There have been since. There are both monuments on the bridge where Ed Johnson was lynched. It's now a linear bridge, a walking bridge, a park. And there's also several other memorials in Chattanooga. We located his gravestone. And then also a couple of Supreme Courts in Georgia, Tennessee, and Illinois have put up memorials to the two lawyers, Pardon and Hutchins, for their work.
Mark Currodin is the author of Contempt of Court, a turn-of-the-century lynching that launched 100 years of federalism. He's scheduled to discuss the book tomorrow afternoon at 2 in the E.J. Ball Courtroom at the University of Arkansas School of Law. The program, sponsored by Public Discussion NWA, is worth 1 hour of Ethics CLE credit and is offered free of charge.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Additional support comes from Highlands Oncology Group, helping patients fight the battle every day with a team of cancer specialists in both Benton and Washington counties. Services include radiation, CLIA-certified labs, a multidisciplinary lung clinic, and a lung cancer screening program. HighlandsOncologyGroup.com. Additional support provided by Butterfield Trail Village, a premier Northwest Arkansas retirement community catering to active lifestyles and resident well-being. Offering a variety of amenities and living options from apartments to village homes, plus on-site fitness facilities. ButterfieldTrailVillage.org.
Still to come on today's show, history has many examples of when medicine was not doing harm.
There is a large section, especially with women's health, that deals with the history of hysteria and the hysterical disease that was brought upon woman merely by the presence within her of the womb, and how that was thought to take a woman beyond the ability to be a rational being.
An upcoming public talk and honor symposium reflects on the ways medicine has been harmful and what we can learn from those episodes. That's ahead on today's Ozarks at Large.
Breaking news travels really fast, and sometimes it's hard to keep up.
Used a vulgar slur in reference to
injured in a school shooting in Western
Kentucky. Prompting a shutdown on
Larry Nassar will spend at least 40 years in prison.
In a week, an Amtrak train has crashed.
An emergency alert that there was.
Deciphering what it means doesn't have to be difficult. Morning Edition is here to unpack the day's biggest stories and to dig into all the details. Listen every day.
Every weekday morning from 5 to 9 on 91.3. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. A celebration of Black History Month continues today with the Northwest Arkansas NAACP Founders Day celebration. Compassion Fayetteville, in partnership with the local chapter of the NAACP, has planned events throughout the month to mark the annual holiday. Patty Williams, co-leader of this year's celebration, says Black history should be discussed beyond the month of February.
In actuality, Black history should be celebrated every day of the year, should be celebrated in history classes, in art museums, intermingled with everything. But it's important to take time out, I think, and we think, to focus on, particularly in Fayetteville, making Black lives visible and relevant, and that the history of African Americans is celebrated.
Now in its fourth year, the annual observance has expanded beyond Fayetteville to include events in Bentonville and Springdale.
It just shows that when you become visible and you take stands and you celebrate history and you also acknowledge the painful parts, in this case of Black history, that there are other people beyond Fayetteville that care and want to do the same thing. So it's kind of like you drop a stone in and the ripple, you know, and it's the ripple effect. And what could be better?
The 2018 celebration includes an inaugural Black History Month parade on February 24th in Fayetteville. An entire list of the month's events can be found by searching for Compassion Fayetteville Black History Month on Facebook. More people continue to fly out of the Fort Smith and Northwest Arkansas regional airports. Enplanements for both airports in 2017 increased over the previous year. Enplanements are outbound passengers. The number for Northwest Arkansas regional increased last year for a sixth consecutive year, according to Talk Business and Politics, to the highest level yet, more than 725,000 outgoing passengers. That's up more than 3.5% over 2016. Last year, there were more than 89,500 employments out of Fort Smith Regional, an increase of 2.4% over the previous year. The recently passed federal two-year spending bill means several community health centers will continue to receive funding. There are more than 100 such community centers in Arkansas, including more than two dozen in western and northwest Arkansas. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services reports more than 70% of clinics' operating costs are covered by the federal government. Well, Shannon Spencer, CEO of Community Health Centers of Arkansas, says clinics in the state have maintained budgetary holds.
I had much anxiety because health centers have tried to migrate the effects of the funding delay by, you know, foregoing major investments. Or, you know, dipping into the reserves, I thought about just not being able to expand and the likelihood of centers having to cut services or just staff and the other actions that they were having to consider, you know, in large numbers. And those cuts could have reversed gains, but we are so excited. And in particular, Arkansas federal delegates, they recognize the significance that health centers play an important role in rural and medically underserved communities.
And she says community clinics try to financially plan to protect operations during uncertain funding times.
And what our health centers directors have been able to do, just like operating any other organization, you ensure that you plan for a potential rainy day. Some of our health center leaders, they have just maybe 1 month or 2 months in reserve just for different type of emergencies, such as a potential funding cliff that we just faced.
The federal funding had expired last fall and was, before the federal spending bill was passed, expected to be out of money by April. A legendary Arkansas radio personality is being remembered as a pioneer. Sunshine Sonny Payne hosted the radio show King Biscuit Time on KFAA in Helena, West Helena, since 1951. The show, which began in the 1940s, is believed to be the oldest daily blues show in the world and is one of the oldest operating shows in the United States. Payne had suffered a fall at his home in December, and he died Saturday. He was 92. Officials with the radio station say the longtime show will continue with new hosts, but will not be the same without Payne. The 2018 Fort Smith Marathon is over after a cold race day yesterday. The best time was turned in by David Hildebrand. He finished the course in 3 hours, 7 minutes, and 58 seconds. And the Arkansas gymnastics team is ranked as high as it has been all season. In this morning's Road to Nationals poll, Arkansas is again ranked 8th in the country after scoring its second highest score of the year Friday night in a victory over Auburn at Bud Walton Arena. This weekend, Arkansas will be in St. Louis for the Mardi Gras Invitational that also includes number 4 in the country LSU and number 20 Missouri. The next home meet is March 2nd against number 17 Arizona.
With the Department of Arkansas Heritage, I'm Mark Chris of the Arkansas World War I Centennial Commemoration Committee. 100 years ago, on February 5th, 1918, a German submarine torpedoed the steamer Tuscania off the Isle of Islay between Scotland and Ireland. Among the 2,000 men aboard the Tuscania were members of the 20th Engineers Regiment, the Fighting Foresters. The largest regiment to ever exist in the U.S. Army, the 20th Engineers was recruited from foresters across the country to provide lumber and building materials for the Army in France. 3 British warships came to the aid of the stricken vessel, and 1,800 men were saved before the Tuscania slipped beneath the waves. Of the 200 Americans who died, 95 were from the 6th Battalion of the 20th Engineers, including Arkansans Private Claude Bradley of Bucksnort and Corporal Nathan Short of Stevens. The 20th Engineers would record an impressive record of support during World War I, cutting 200 million board feet of lumber, 4 million railroad ties, and 340,000 cords of firewood during hostilities. To learn more, visit ww1arkansas.com.
Medical advances have made lives better. It's an impressive list of achievement: penicillin, aspirin, artificial knees, and many more. But medical history also has its dark side. Horrific accounts of people in power using medicine and medical authority to quiet, punish, or harm others. Bad medicine will be the subject of an Honors College signature seminar next fall at the University of Arkansas. It will be led by Tricia Starks, Associate Professor of History at the U of A. This week, she'll give a public preview of matters to be covered in that seminar series with a free lecture Wednesday evening at 5:15 in Gearhart Hall Auditorium. Tricia Starks says she's long been fascinated by the history of medical practice.
I've had for a long time courses and work in public health and history of medicine that have been about a triumph of public health in the ways that health and medicine have really improved our lives over the centuries. Yet I always was drawn to the other face of medicine, the cruel, the dangerous, the poorly thought out, and the failures. And so this course really focuses on those points where medicine goes bad.
I know many times when people think in the past of medicine that didn't work, might be thinking towards mental health, where perhaps practitioners a few decades or a couple of centuries ago didn't have the knowledge we have now of how to handle mental health. Mm-hmm. Does that make up a lot of the...
There is a large section, especially with women's health, that deals with the history of hysteria and the hysterical disease that was brought upon women merely by the presence within her of the womb, and how that was thought to take a woman beyond the ability to be a rational being. And so we look at some of the more difficult answers to that question of how does one deal with a woman. Horrible things like hysterectomies or clitoridectomies that were practiced upon women so as to get rid of those attributes that were seen as aberrant within especially 19th century Victorian morality, women who were hypersexual or overly aggressive. And so looking at surgical means of identifying and changing female behavior is a cornerstone of one segment of the course.
It sounds as if you can't discuss this topic without talking about who has power and who wields power.
Yes, that is very definitely true, that medicine, we give up an enormous amount of power to physicians because they give us a feeling of security. Even when they give us bad diagnoses, we are comforted by the idea of at least knowing where our bodies are going, what path we can anticipate, whether it be a minor thing like a cold or a major thing like a cancer. We are looking for answers as to whether we can get that, whether our family members, what they can anticipate. We hope for a narrative, an answer, a beginning and an ending, even if those are beginnings and endings that are poor. Yet when we give that power over to the physician, we also allow them to control that narrative. And so we are, in effect, becoming patients that are able to both participate in and be victims of our own health diagnosis.
How far back do you go in the bad medicine curriculum?
The majority of the class takes place within the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. But we go all the way back to Aristotle, Galen, and Hippocrates so as to look at the humoral origins of ideas of male and female.
How, with the advantage of hindsight, how much of these horrible practices, bad practices, failed practices can we assign to ignorance? How much can we assign to sheer, power control? And does it get murky?
I think it gets very murky. One of the things that brought me to teach this class was the interest that students always have in eugenics, the Holocaust, and sterilization in the 20th century.
And those are all, of course, horrible practices and have these tragic stories, ones that students often only associated with Nazi Germany, but they miss the fact that in the United States there was sterilization of some 60 to 70,000 people over the course of the 20th century. And so there is this origin story to that that is bound up in politics and economics and social control that I don't think can really be teased out as to whether it's a positive or negative. It is the effect of power and medicine working together. That medicine was born at the French Revolution in terms of clinical medicine, hospital medicine as we understand it practiced. Yet also within the French Revolution was the idea that it was the duty of a citizen to be healthy. And the state was helpful in defining what a healthy citizen was. A healthy citizen was productive. A healthy citizen was involved in politics if male, but if female, was a Republican mother bringing up the next generation, a healthy womb for a healthy citizen. And so women and men were given idealized occupations, statuses, behaviors, and anyone that stepped outside of those was then found somehow aberrant, deviant, different. And medical professionals helped to define those things and look towards cures.
Well, you mentioned the start with the French Revolution, but certainly I'm guessing that it spread through Europe and that sort of same guideline was in the United States.
Well, the French Revolution, interestingly enough, gives birth to this clinical medicine that then becomes the touchstone of medical education throughout the Western world. France is where one went to study medicine because they had these state hospitals that allowed you ready access to poor patients on whom to practice medicine. And that practice is where doctors learned how to, at the very least, diagnose. They couldn't really do a lot of curing in the early 1800s. But by the late 19th century, that practice had spread. And so they had the medical education system that started there spread forward into the rest of the world.
I imagine it's impossible then to talk about bad medicine without talking about adjacent social movements. If women are supposed to be Republican mothers, lowercase r, and raise the next generation, if women begin to say, wait, we want a chance to vote, this will come in conflict with these prescribed medical guidelines.
Yes, that is exactly true. That women who became, this is where hysteria comes back into the picture, is that women that become politically active, women who become interested in work outside the home, are seen as going outside of the norms and prone to hysteria. They could be diagnosed for this. They could be pushed into hysterectomies or other kinds of surgeries by interested male family members. Now, of course, this is a concept that is very much associated with the upper classes, the Republican motherhood. For the lower classes, it can be an aspirational, or it can be turned on its head that lower class women, we see these concepts really applied towards prostitutes as women who are outside the norm and therefore need to be either medically supervised or medically treated, and they also then become vectors for disease for other males.
What has helped eradicate some of this bad medicine over the centuries and decades?
I think in some ways it is the increasing diversity of the medical profession, as well as the understanding of social movements to help identify the rights of those that are often outside of the power structure of white European male medical professions. And so, for instance, if we look at the case of hysteria, as we see an expansion of women's rights, especially in the 1920s and 1930s, hysteria becomes less and less a diagnosis, and it finally falls out of favor in much of the Western world by World War II. But also there are horrific examples like the Tuskegee syphilis experiments, which we work across in this class, where the the exposure of that as part of the civil rights movement is both the two work off of each other in terms of exposing bad medicine and curing bad medicine. As you see the horrific non-treatment of African Americans with syphilis that were taken through the Tuskegee experiments, and then see the aftermath of that, it led to a massive change in medical ethics and especially experimental medicine.
It's so hard to think of a time when, again, this is presentism, but to go back and think that there could be medical professionals who think they're working in the best interest by denying or purposely infecting other human beings.
And there's always that for the greater good issue within medicine, and that pressure within that medical professionals are always being torn between their care for the individual and their idea of the greater good, or looking towards the greater good of society. Even when we have medical experimentation with new drugs, there's the control group that doesn't get the drug, and yet there is that pressure often of, well, this drug is working. Can I start giving it to the rest of the control group? And we have these protocols to make sure that we keep an ethical and also rigid double-blind structure to make sure that experimental medicine is done correctly and done productively.
It seems that there are two, and this is making something very obvious or very simple that isn't simple, but you have bad medicine in the past that was just based on bad information, leeches or something like that. You know, we'll cure your malady through a practice we now know doesn't work. But then there also seems to be bad medicine that really took marginalized people. And at some level, practitioners had to know that this wasn't, while it might have been for the greater good, wasn't good for these individuals. So, again, this goes back to, is this murky or not? I mean, there's bad medicine that's just we didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And are there examples, pretty good examples of bad medicine where perhaps the practitioners did know that this was bad medicine for the people involved?
I think the Tuskegee syphilis experiments are definitely a place where they understood there were individuals that came out saying this is wrong and we need to do something. And there's a lot of pushback within the institutional structure. But there are other cases, such as the longstanding tradition of sterilizing women who were seen as dangerous or not fit mothers, such as the Carrie Buck decision in the United States, where the decision was made at the Supreme Court level that I believe the quote is, three generations of imbeciles is enough, and that the state should have the power to sterilize women that were seen as unfit based upon eugenic science that was not a well-thought-out science, was not a science. And so we have the sterilization laws from the United States that were then used as base for the sterilization laws in Nazi Germany.
When you mentioned that quote, three generations of imbeciles, that was actually something that one of the Supreme Court justices wrote.
Yes.
We would like to think. Here we are in 2018 and we're past bad medicine.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure if you and I were to sit down here again 30 years from now, we'd realize we're not.
Right. Right. The course ends with a set of articles that was in the New York Times after Hurricane Katrina regarding bad choices at Memorial. It was a hospital in New Orleans that during the course of the hurricane and the aftermath thereof, there were people that were, well, the article sets up the debate of whether they were euthanized, denied care, or what actually went on. And the course ends with that debate of where, how much power do doctors still have, and where have we reached a line where bad medicine is no longer available, or whether it's just now being institutionalized in different ways.
Most of the people that will be in the signature seminar mm-hmm. are, I'm going to say, in their 20s, late teens, I mean, young, traditional college-age students. What do you hope that they can come away with after a semester of this seminar?
I often get a lot of science students and pre-med students, biology students, anthropology students in this course. And I hope they come away with an understanding that science is never outside of culture, that medicine is never outside of society, that as much as we might like to think that these things are not tempered by emotion, prejudice, cultural constructs, misogyny, that these things are always around us and we must be therefore very careful in how we practice, that any medicine can become very quickly bad medicine if we do not practice consciously and globally think about the consequences of our actions.
One kind of silly question. Because you research and teach about this, do you think you're a better patient when you go see a medical practitioner? Do you ask more questions?
No. Indeed, I went in to the hospital a few years back after I had started teaching this course, and I was amazed at how quickly I handed over all power to the physician. I was the nurses, whatever they wanted to give me. I was ready to take whatever drug, whatever they said was important and needed to be done. I was very ready to hand that over. But I will say I was much more conscious of myself giving over that power. And so I recognized what I was doing, but it did not stop me from having strong faith in my medical professionals.
Tricia Starks is an associate professor of history at the University of Arkansas, and Wednesday she will give a talk about bad medicine. It will begin at 5:15 in Gearhart Hall Auditorium on the U of A campus. The talk is free and open to the public. And in the fall, she'll lead an Honors College signature seminar on the subject.
Maybe you're new to the KUAF listening area. Just like it was before, public radio is a part of your life here, too. Of course, you get the reliable news and information you've come to expect from NPR, but we'll also help you learn about the ins and outs of this region. From the folk music programs on Saturday nights, to our daily local news magazine, Ozarks at Large, to the community spotlight series that highlights the good work being done by groups in our area. Before you know it, KUAF has become that trusted friend you rely on as you navigate your new home. Celebrate that new friendship by becoming a new member of KUAF and make your first-time donation at supportkuaf.com.
There are many public and private preschools operating across Arkansas, but one based in Fayetteville, Mighty Minds, may be one of the few and possibly only bilingual pre-K operations in Arkansas. Advocates claim early bilingual education improves cognitive function, as well as encouraging cultural tolerance. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich tells us more.
Students at Mighty Minds Bilingual Pre-K on Porter Road in Fayetteville start every class day with a rather off-key version of "We're Gonna Have a Good Day." Administrator Jay Edwards, a professional musician, leads the children in song. His spouse, Ruth Edwards, operates the school. She's a certified early education and elementary school teacher based first in Puerto Rico, then later in Texas. She's also a nationally noted language technology expert, building custom interactive programs like this language learning dance. Arkansas Public Schools are required to offer English learning courses to non-English speaking students to gain an equitable and adequate education. But Mighty Minds, the only bilingual pre-K in Northwest Arkansas, which opened last August, is referred to as a dual language school.
In the morning, we teach Spanish.
and in the afternoon we teach English. So the students that don't know Spanish, they will learn Spanish, and the students that don't know English, they will learn English.
Dual language K-12 education is trending. It offers language immersion, where instructors speak only in a given language for extended periods. Most dual language schools in the U.S. provide English and Spanish learning, although Arabic, Chinese, French, and Asian language skills are increasingly being offered.
Estrella, estrella,
mano, mano,
mano, mano.
The Edwards say bilingual pre-K schools are rare, especially in Arkansas, which has a growing Hispanic population. It's why they moved here from Texas. Rogers and Springdale School District student populations, according to State Education Department data, is 45% Hispanic. Fayetteville's district is 12% Hispanic. Currently, all Mighty Minds enrolled students are English speakers, except for one child who recently moved here from Puerto Rico. He's already forming English phrases, but was too shy to show us. He's also learning English and Spanish literacy, along with a half a dozen other subjects.
We teach science in Spanish, social studies in Spanish, and then in the afternoon, we do math in English. And we integrate literacy in English, so they're going to learn how to read and write in English and numbers in English.
What happens is we have one student here that the parents speak English, but the grandmother only speaks Spanish. So there's a language barrier in the family. So coming here, when the kid is bilingual, then they can communicate with the whole family. We have another student here that the student only speaks Spanish.
Jay Edwards' parents served as teachers and school administrators, so operating Mighty Minds is a natural fit for him. He also works part-time as a truck driver to help support the independent school startup. He's originally from the Pine Bluff region. The couple met in Texas. Mighty Minds, an independent private school, enrolls 2.5 to 6-year-olds. Tuition is $185 a week, which includes breakfast and lunch. Registration, $75, plus a $50 per semester materials fee, which includes all digital services and devices. But to encourage new enrollees, the new school's waiving both fees and has discounted weekly enrollment to $150. Mighty Minds is also offering Spanish immersion camp this summer for children ages 30 months to 12 years.
In 3 weeks, we have students that did not speak English did not speak Spanish when they got here. And in 3 weeks, they were already speaking Spanish and words for sure, and some in sentences in 3 weeks. And Ruth has built her own program and her own system that we use here, and it's very effective.
The Edwards say bilingual language learning and research backs them up, spurs brain development in young children who absorb and can retain up to 3 languages naturally. They also learn about cultural diversity, tolerance, and will graduate with a set of language skills providing certain career advantages in their adult lives. Ruth Edwards teaches Spanish and English using iPads, laptops, whiteboards, puzzles, games, and large interactive video classroom screen. The spacious one-room school contains private desks, tiny tables, and cubby workstations.
So we have Pretend and Learn Center, Black Art Center, ABC Center, Science, Math, Writing Center, and iPad Center, Computer Center, Library over here, Sand, and Play-Doh Center.
The children are also given homework, which Ruth can assess remotely. We interrupt the children who've been quietly studying and playing with a few questions. Full disclosure, my high school Spanish is really rough.
¿Cómo te llama?
Eli.
Oh, ¿cuántos años?
5.
Eli, an English speaker, is a very serious guy. He's 5 years old. We give Phoenix, another English speaker, a quick test. He's the eldest child here, age 6.
How do you say dog in Spanish?
Pedro.
How do you say cat?
Gato.
Muy bien. Can you count?
Uno, dos, tres, cuatro, cinco, seis, siete, ocho, nueve, diez.
A gang of toddlers grapple with giant letter blocks spelling out Spanish words, as well as nonsense. At another table, the children do timed flashcards.
Casa. Casa.
Pera. Casa. Lupe.
According to the nonprofit Pew Research Center, the Hispanic population in the U.S. has reached 58 million, or 18% of us, and currently accounts for half of the nation's population growth since 2000 via both migration and birth rate. Data show that little children immersed in a foreign language are better able to recognize symbolic relationships between letters, characters, and sounds, leading to excellent reading skills. And while immersed, children may also absorb native accents. Bilingualism and biliteracy, research indicates, can also encourage attention development and cooperative engagement with others. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
And you can scroll through Mighty Mind's website in either English or Spanish. We have a link at ozarksatlarge.com. And if you ever miss an edition of Ozarks at Large, don't forget, we're available. It's an absolutely free podcast. You can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher. You can also find us on the NPR One app and the KUAF app.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The Arkansas Philharmonic Orchestra welcomes violinist Eugene Kong Saturday, February 17th at the Arend Arts Center in Bentonville. Under the direction of maestro Stephen Bias, Kong and the APO will perform Violin Concerto No. 2 of Arkansas composer Florence Beatrice Price. ArkansasPhilharmonic.org for tickets.
It is Monday, the 12th day of February, 2018. With me at the Carver Center for Public Radio is Becca Martin-Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette. Happy Monday.
Hi. How are you?
I'm great.
Me too.
Good.
Okay, so we have, okay, you know, a while back, What's Up packed its bags and moved from Friday to Sunday.
What's Up, the segment, one of the things you do at the newspaper that covers as much as it can about entertainment, cuisine,
arts,
and culture.
Yes.
So it used to be Friday. Now it's on in the Sunday paper.
And one of the bonuses we got, they put this thing in the middle that's TV stuff and puzzles and we used to call it amusements in the old days of the Springdale News.
Right.
So we go 12 pages in, and then there's this thing, and then there's the back 40. Mm-hmm. I'm probably not supposed to refer to it as the back 40. The advertising director would probably be unhappy, but we think of it as the back 40. And it's given us an opportunity to do some cool stuff.
All right.
So we have, on the last Sunday of the month, a visual arts calendar, which we've had for a long time, but now we have more room for it. On the first Sunday of the month, we have a Best Bets calendar that looks at that coming month and what we think are the coolest things happening. On the second Sunday of the month, we have an Arts Away calendar that looks at things in Tulsa and Springfield
and
Kansas City, a day's drive. And on the next one, we have a museum list. Well, we have a story that accompanies most of those. Some of them we write. Some of them I lift from the nice people in Little Rock at the Democrat Gazette to remind people of what's going on down there. Well, the name Ed Stilley means something to you, right?
Ed Stilley creates these guitars that are like no others. He uses bed springs and saw blades, and they're of all shapes and sizes and tones.
And lives out in the middle of nowhere at Hogscald Holler in Madison County. And I don't know that any of us would have ever heard of him, except Kelly and Donna Mulholland met him. They're still on the hill. They used to be Toucan Jam.
Mm-hmm.
And they have this passion for telling Arkansas stories. So they ended up doing a book about his musical instruments. And then there ended up being an exhibit about his musical instruments, which is still open at the Old State House Museum in Little Rock.
Oh, cool.
So that's the tie-in to the Arts Away. The exhibit is called True Faith, True Light,
mm-hmm.
which he's written on some of his guitars,
right.
The Devotional Art of Ed Stilley. And they've got 30 of his instruments, guitars and mandolins and banjos, all made in this I believe it's safe to use the word unique way.
Sure is.
Plus, they have x-rays.
Yeah,
of their
so you
innards.
Can see what he put in there, yeah.
Because if he wanted an instrument to resonate a particular way.
Again, bed springs or something like that.
He found something to make it do that. And so this is only open through March at the Old State House. It's free.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the Northwest Arkansas thing that we're showing off in Little Rock.
Very good.
And I love it when that happens. You can Google oldstatehouse.com, and you can look this coming Sunday for the museum list and a museum feature in the back 40. Don't just stop when you get to page 13.
Gotcha.
Also this week, what is it that you're doing Wednesday night? Something interesting.
Yes, at the Fayetteville Public Library, it's a conversation with Stephen Karam, who is the writer of the Tony Award-winning and Pulitzer-nominated drama The Humans, currently in production by Theater Squared. It'll be a moderated conversation featuring him, the director and the artistic director of T2. 6 o'clock, free, Valentine's night. Then you've got the rest of the night to do more.
And he's doing a writing workshop earlier in the day.
Yep. So he's had two plays that were Pulitzer finalists, by the way.
And he's had another show that was produced here. This is his second T2 show.
Yes.
So that'll be cool. On Thursday night, oh, and there's a Valentine's concert. If you leave 15 minutes early, I said this the other day, and run to Ozark Folkways
what
in Winslow.
What time does this concert start?
7 o'clock. You might be a few minutes late.
Oh, wait a second. I'm just going to tell you that if you're trying to get to Winslow to see it start, 6:45 ain't going to do it.
I didn't want him to leave sooner than
that. Well, no, I don't either. You've got a choice here. but you're, you know, don't go
you're
90 miles per
there.
Hour.
All right. Well, when you get to Ozark Folkways in Winslow, Susan Shore and Michael Cochran and Emily Cates and Drew Pierce are going to do a Valentine's Day concert. And it's a $10 donation at the door.
Sounds fun.
And then on Thursday, The Little Foxes opens at Fort Smith Little Theater. Lillian Hellman drama, a black-hearted leading lady, greedy, unscrupulous siblings, money, and Southern hospitality circa 1900 Alabama.
It's about control of a family business and whatnot.
Yeah. And then on Friday, all sorts of things going on, including the opening of The Hunchback of Notre Dame at the Barry Performing Arts Center at JBU, put on there by their drama department.
Quasimodo and Esmeralda.
And on Friday, we'll have our broadsheet page in the second section of the paper called SUP, nice. Which is a reminder of all the things we already told you about.
But just one more little reminder.
Yes.
Becca Martin Brown, features editor of the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
I'm Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A. The news has been relentless, but we can help keep you savvy and sane as you continue to listen to this station throughout the day. That's 1A, weekdays from WAMU and NPR.
Every weekday from 9 to 11 on 91.3. A listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. This is 91.3 KUAF. Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Elkins. Elkins officially incorporated as a community this week in 1964. It was February 19th, 1964, when Elkins became incorporated. It was a combination of the communities Harris and Hood. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for listening. Back with you again tomorrow at noon and 7 p.m. for another brand new edition of Daily Ozarks at Large. If you would like to share any of the stories or interviews you hear on Ozarks at Large on any number of social media platforms or through email, we make that pretty easy to do. You can go to KUAF.com or OzarksAtLarge.com. And you can take us with you. We are a podcast as well, available for free through services like iTunes, Stitcher, the NPR One app, and the absolutely free KUAF app. You can learn more about those at OzarksAtLarge.com and KUAF.com as well. Thanks so much for spending part of your Monday with us. Back again tomorrow.